Support for Innovation Hub comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, analyzing the genetic weaknesses of more than 25,000 tumors to craft precision treatments for cancer. More at danafarber.org/beatcancer. And Northeastern University, offering an education without boundaries, with campuses in Boston, Charlotte, Seattle, Silicon Valley, and Toronto. You can learn more at northeastern.edu.
Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. In 1946, Winston Churchill settled in for a night of poker. He'd been playing the game for more than 40 years, and he wasn't shy about letting people know he was good at it. This particular game was played on a train, and his opponents were President Harry Truman and his staff. Churchill, unfortunately, got creamed, and he lost a ton of money. So much so that when he left the room for a moment, Truman told his folks to ease up. It was a rough night, and it came during a rough period for Churchill. He had been an inspirational leader during World War II, but in 1945, Britain cast him and his party out of leadership. Meanwhile, the world was changing in ways that concerned him. The Soviet Union was amassing power, and Europe was struggling through a painful recovery after widespread bombing, huge death tolls, and economic ruin. There was, however, what Churchill saw as a solution.
We must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way only will hundreds of millions of toilers be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living.
This idea of a kind of single united Europe was invented after the war. Even though the countries involved had, in many cases, been at each other's throats for hundreds of years. The new idea was embraced by lots of rich, powerful folks. And to be fair, it still is.
I've been to any number of speeches and presentations over the years in Brussels and Frankfurt and Berlin, where they point out that, you know, if you look at Europe as a whole, in many ways, it's actually bigger than the U.S. as a single market.
That's Gillian Tett, the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times.
The problem, of course, is that, you know, it's one thing to say, yes, we'd like to be the United States of Europe, or at least punch above our weight on the world stage. To do that, though, you need to have clear-cut decision-making and a clear mythology, founding father mythology, and a clear vision, which is clearly not the case.
The most obvious reflection of that lack of vision is Britain's contentious struggle to get out of the European Union and the British government's seeming inability to manage a huge mess of competing desires. Fortunately, Tett says, in a continent where countries are ticked off at one another and no one ever seems happy with the deals they negotiate, there's been a recent and rare feeling of unity.
The arrival of Donald Trump has so horrified most Europeans that it's actually galvanized to unite them in opposition to a degree.
So there's that. But still, you have to ask, and we're going to, whoever cooked up this idea that Europe should be a single entity, who thought, hey, let's invent a new currency. And as Europe tries to recreate itself, how are its decisions changing the world? Mark Blythe, a professor of international economics at Brown University, says, if you go back to the beginning, the very beginning, you will find an unlikely player, America. And we weren't just present at the creation of this new Europe. We helped create it. Why? Well, if you had to sum it up in one word, Germany.
So the original foundation was called the European Coal and Steel Community. And the basic idea here was originally an American idea, which was you can't kind of tell the Germans not to be an industrial power. Right at the end of World War II, Treasury Secretary Morgenthau had this idea of pastoralizing Germany. Basically, you can stay farmers, but you can't do anything else because you're too much trouble. And of course, that was ridiculous. But what they wanted to do is to make sure that the weapons of warfare, particularly heavy metals, coal, steel, the stuff you need for tanks and causing trouble, was in a sense spread out amongst the Europeans themselves. So this took a long time. It didn't begin as a large political project. It was very much small steps to do with security. And then from security, it went into building essentially a customs union to lower tariff barriers and trade barriers and to get trade going amongst these economies so that the real recovery could begin. And in that regard, it was remarkably successful.
Hmm. Gillian, do you think that as these steps, kind of how Mark lays out, as these steps went little by little towards this vision of like one Europe, do you think in some ways the elites were out of touch with like ordinary Europeans in this project?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems with the whole Eurozone project can be captured if you pick up a euro note, a euro bank note. Hmm. Because if you look at the backside of a euro note, what you have are pictures of windows and pillars and buildings rather than faces. It's almost unique in the world that you have a currency or bank note with no faces on. And the reason for that is that when the European leaders were trying to create the Eurozone banknotes, they didn't really have any clear-cut figures or faces who had basically been part of the founding mythology. I mean, America has all the founding fathers, the Hamiltons, all of those. In Europe, no one really knows quite who created a modern Europe. And what's even worse is because it's a consensus-driven system, they couldn't even agree on any buildings or windows or arches to use on the banknotes. So you have imaginary buildings and arches and windows to not offend anybody. And to me, as a former anthropologist who trained in anthropology before I became a journalist, this lack of any clear-cut founding mythology to unify the continent, the lack of people who, or faces from history that ordinary people to look to, is part of the core problem today.
Mark, you were talking about how the original idea here was, hey, Germany, you cannot be quite the industrial power that you once were. So here's a new idea. You'll be part of a unified Europe. Did this plan, without like that benefit of a common heritage, did it in some ways slip under the radar? Because, like I said, it kind of came in small steps.
Yes, but there's also something else going on, which Gillian's quite right about. There's no founding fathers. But what there were was a collection of, let's say, founding fatherly midwives around the 1970s and 1980s. When they passed from the scene, the next generation of leaders that came up, Schroeder, who was the German Chancellor, Tony Blair, they just didn't care for the project in the same way. And a lot of that had to do was they were not the World War II generation. Right, the people that pushed it forward in the 80s, they remembered the war. That's why they thought the European project was important. By the time you get to the 1990s, you have a new generation of politicians that were not part of that post-war generation. And for them, the project really slipped back to sort of the second most important thing every day rather than the first most important thing.
Yeah, I'd say to me, the great tragedy of what's happened in the European Union in the last 5 years is that a project which was really created in reaction to war and to avoid another war and with a hope of reducing hostilities between different nations has, in the last 5 to 10 years, ended up actually exacerbating those tensions and hostilities. And to my mind, it's really came to a head around the Greek crisis because in an ideal world, the most intelligent way to cope with the fact that Greece was plunging into recession would have been to essentially, you know, I sometimes joke, create a gigantic German-funded Club Med holiday camp inside Greece. And that way you could have used public money in Germany to actually pay German pensioners to go on holiday in Greece. Much the same way, frankly, that Florida attracts snowbirds in winter who come down from the industrial parts of the Midwest, and you get the kind of transfers you need across economic borders. Of course, that never happened. And in fact, what ended up happening is that Germans and Greeks are more at odds with each other than they've ever been in recent history, which is a tragedy.
Well, Gillian, I mean, when you talk about, you know, people really hoping after World War II and thinking just this can never happen again, we've got to sort of knit these groups of people together. Was that ignoring hundreds of years of history in which the Germans and the French were fighting, in which the French and the English were fighting? Like, was it saying ignore things that in some ways, you know, you were talking about anthropology before and founding myths were like foundational to the way that people thought about themselves, maybe in opposition to other groups of people?
Well, people always define themselves in opposition to other people, and people are always tribal in the sense of having an identity. But it's entirely possible to create a group identity that transcends local ethnic identities. It's entirely possible for identities to change quite radically over time. I mean, just look at Switzerland, which has, you know, a whole mishmash of different identities, and yet they haven't been trying to kill each other for the last few hundred years. And in fact, Swiss are pretty coordinated. The problem, unfortunately, is that the economic incentives within the European Union system in the last few years have switched from putting everybody on the same page and aligned to a situation where they're not aligned. And as you've had those economic incentives misaligned, economic pressures come up as a result of the crisis, and plus the rise of populism right across the Western world. It's created a very nasty cocktail where nationalism is now the order of the day in populism rather than any sense of pan-continental integration.
Mark, do you want to talk about that a little bit in sort of we think about populism here in the U.S. You know, people were sort of very focused on what's happening here, and there's a lot happening here, so that's not surprising. But, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about how we're a piece, the U.S. is a piece in something that really indeed is going on in Europe and is affecting this European project?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the phrase that I like for this is global Trumpism. So essentially, a simple way to think about this is back in 2008 when we had the financial crisis, the assets and incomes of the top 20% of all of these rich countries was effectively bailed out by the government and reinsured by the taxpayer. In many countries, particularly in southern Europe, where that crisis became acute, that was then accompanied by rather savage cuts to public expenditure. Transfers became conditional. The finger-pointing of northern saints and southern sinners, the virtuous Germans and the spendthrift Spaniards became the order of the day. And what was very much what Gillian was talking about, this kind of coming together of Europe, this polyglot identity of Europeanness, was absolutely cast against national stereotypes. And once you let that stuff out of the box, it's very hard to put it back in. So what's happened throughout Europe is very similar to what's happened in America, even if it has its own particular cadence because of what happened in the euro crisis. But essentially, when you've presided over the largest increase in for example, economic inequality in modern history, you have a financial crisis that basically bails out top income earners, and then you put this in nationalistic terms, you're going to get a reaction. And that reaction is a loss of faith in the mainstream political classes that have been governing Europe and have been the drivers of the European project. So Europe itself becomes the target. It becomes the football in this new nationalist competition.
And maybe both of you can talk about this, but, you know, just as we've seen here, concern about immigration and rising concerns, and certainly the current president embodies that in a clear way, that's also not limited to the U.S. And, you know, part of this issue of like bringing together the different peoples of Europe is people are concerned about people who are not them and immigrants and the ease of immigration. Mark, do you want to start on that and then Gillian?
Sure. I mean, an interesting example of this is what happened in Sweden recently. So they have their own sort of nationalist populist party, the Swedish Democrats, and they came very close to becoming the majority party in the Swedish parliament. Now, was this about immigration? Well, yes, but it's not as if there was a sudden spike in immigration concerns in Sweden if you look at the data on public opinion. Rather, what people were reacting to was a kind of elite consensus amongst the Swedish governing classes that if anyone questions anything about immigration, you're a racist. So you just can't talk about this. And by pushing this off the agenda and refusing to engage in any debate about it at all, it kind of inspired this nationalist backlash. And I think that's part of what's going on, that there's a policy consensus in many areas which has emerged across the rich countries of the world over the past 20 years, where certain things are just not spoken about. And immigration became one of those things. Therefore, in a time of economic and social stress, it becomes politicized, and it gets a particular cadence and becomes particularly important in that moment.
Gillian, it seems like, you know, to go back to your discussion about founding ideas, you know, I think of Minority Leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, saying that we sort of want to be known by the Statue of Liberty rather than Trump's wall. And part of inventing a single Europe is figuring out, OK, well, who's in Europe and who isn't? Who is European and who really doesn't qualify?
Well, you've absolutely put your finger on the central problem, which is that because there hasn't been a founding mythology, because there's never been a single vicious fight to unify Europe or to define the borders of Europe, because you've never had, frankly, the Civil War or any of the American history, the boundaries of Europe have never been clearly defined. During the Cold War, they were essentially defined by the Iron Curtain, but that's obviously changed radically now. And one of the central problems is that, you know, the US might talk about immigration as a big problem and talk about the Hispanic immigration. But that's been a very slow burn issue that's, you know, built up over a number of years, and is part of the fabric of America. What's happened in the last 3-4 years with the immigration wave from North Africa and from Syria has really come with a sudden shock. And when Angela Merkel said effectively that the doors were open, she was reflecting the liberal knee-jerk reaction of most European leaders post-World War II, which is to act as a beacon for liberal values and inclusion. But the sheer magnitude and speed at which the immigration crisis has exploded has really blown apart much of that liberal consensus.
Mark, what role, if any, this is hubristic, but what role are we, the U.S., playing in terms of, Europe thinking about who they are and who they need to be?
Well, as Gillian said earlier, we always define ourselves in opposition to someone else. And having elected Trump, you've given Europeans a wonderful figure to rally against and say, we are absolutely not that. Which, of course, is nonsense because they have their own populists, many of whom are just, you know, as Trumpish as Trump is. So, again, that's not really true. The United States doesn't really play a role in Europe beyond hectoring. I mean, we're quite right to do this. This goes to Gillian's point about foreign policy, for example, is they have no military capacity. They've been free riding off of the United States forever. Everything that Trump says about the 2% target for defense spending in NATO, etc., is essentially true and correct. Recently, there's been very heavy snowfall in Europe. And what that's revealed is that the German army, for example, doesn't really have the equipment to deal with heavy snow. So if you're worried about a revanche of Russia coming after you and you can't really deal with the snowfall, you've definitely got some capacity problems. And that's what Trump is exposing. So in a sense, as a figure, he's a polarizing figure, which helps to unify. But on the other hand, what he's doing is pointing out some very real weaknesses in European defense structures, which, you know, they should be more serious about.
We're going to pause for a minute here and come back and talk more with Mark Blythe from Brown and Gillian Tett from the Financial Times about the invention of one Europe, what that means for America, how it's intertwined with the spread of populism, and most importantly, I think, why the EU is like a song by the Eagles. In the meantime, if you want to read more about Winston Churchill's terrible night of poker that I talked about at the beginning, we've got the story for you at our website, innovationhub.org. And in what has got to be one of history's great lines, during that game, when Churchill stepped out of the room for a minute, one of Truman's aides told the president, if you want us to play our best poker for the nation's honor, we'll have this guy's pants before the evening is over. Fortunately, the president didn't let that happen. What are we gonna do? We got the Brexit blues. We will get back to the show in just a minute, but first, a quick plug. If you love Innovation Hub, and since you're listening right now, that's a very good sign, we've got swag for you. Our online store is full of t-shirts and coffee mugs and iPhone cases and other cool stuff featuring our redesigned logo. The link to the store is at our website, innovationhub.org. Money has been spent. Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. And that's not just true in a chemistry lab or a biology lab. It's true in political labs, too. After World War II, America was out in front insisting Germany could not be allowed to become a great industrial power again. There were just too many risks to that. And what was cooked up in the years after the war was a little project that we like to call the European Union. Sure, you were working with countries that had been killing each other's citizens for centuries, but why not? And then, as if creating a new union wasn't enough experimentation, the 1990s brought a new invention, a single currency.
Greece and Germany should not be in the same currency union if they don't have some centralized political making process.
Gillian Tett, the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times, says potentially good ideas about uniting the continent have not been followed up by particularly good political dealing. And then there's this. Welcome to the Hotel California.
So there's an interesting kind of what I call the Hotel California problem with the euro.
That's Mark Blythe, the professor of international economics at Brown University, highlighting a wicked puzzle that, at its end, often distills into a nationalist, populist brew.
Because once you check in, you can't check out. And here's why. So you've been using the euro for 20 years. You don't have a printing press. Let's say you're Italy. You've got bad banks. You've got zombie firms. You're not growing. You've got very high youth unemployment. And let's say there's another financial crisis, and that really threatens the Italian economy in fundamental ways. Well, you can't bail your own banks. You can't print money. You're completely dependent on a currency that you don't control. Now, that means you've got a very serious structural problem if there's a big shock. But over the more normal times as well, it creates a very big problem politically. And this is exemplified by Greece and Italy and other southern countries. You can vote for whatever government you want, but you're really going to have whatever policies the Germans and the secure parts of Europe want to have because you have no autonomy. And if you try and get out of the euro, all of your savings are denominated in euros. If you try and have new lira, you know that new lira is going to trade substantially cheaper than the euro. Everybody will try and open German bank accounts holding euros. It just creates an enormous economic mess. So you've got a problem because democracy is meant to give you choice, including over economics. But you can vote for populists, but they'll behave just like the guys you voted before because you don't really have any real control. And that's the thing that they didn't foresee when the euro came in, was how it's going to disable politics on a national level.
Gillian, when you look back at the Brexit vote, a couple years back, 2.5 years, I think now, and then you look ahead, do you think you know, like, what that vote was about? And do you think... Do you think it's a good idea, would be in Britain's interest to stay in the European Union?
Well, I thought that voting for Brexit was madness. I mean, the part of the problem is that because I have an international life and because I'm professional and because I've, you know, done pretty well in recent years, you know, I am exactly the kind of person who a large part of the population was protesting against. But I thought the vote was madness. After the vote, I went back to the UK and spent a lot of time talking to my friends and family who had voted for Brexit to try and understand what the issues were.
Okay.
And, you know, was forced to go into quite a process of, you know, reflection and thinking about, you know, how countries and elites had become disaggregated. Since then, though, I would welcome Brexit if it was used by the UK as a chance to define a new identity and to actually create a positive agenda for trade, for a self-confident vision of how the UK could work in the future. In fact, that hasn't happened at all. It's been a very negative process, and Brexit's defined by what it's against rather than what it's for right now, and that's tragic.
Mark, when you look back, do you feel like you know what that vote was about? And what do you think, you know, should happen going forward?
Well, a very simple way to think about Brexit is this. A bunch of nationalist Tories in the Conservative Party decided to leave the world's largest free trade zone so that they could have better free trade agreements. Just stop there. It literally makes no sense. This wasn't really about the EU. It was, as Gillian said, this was an opportunity for voice to give a frustrated population that had been through 10 years of hardship a chance to tell their ruling elites exactly what they thought of them. And what the Remain campaign was the entire British ruling classes coming together arm in arm to tell everyone what was in their interests in the most patronising way possible. And the public said, you know what, if you all want this, you're not going to get it. That's, to me, what Brexit was really about.
Sounds like a magic formula.
Yeah, I like to call it Schadenfreude politics, to use a good German word.
So let's look at... I'm interested in what both of you think of this. When you look out, not in the next few months, but in the next few years, and you think about this project that started after World War II and that was going to invent this new community and this new currency, ultimately, what's going to happen to this community? Jillian, do you want to start?
Well, I think anyone who dares to make predictions with great confidence right now about the next 10 years risk looking as almost as foolish as anyone who dare to predict what would happen with Donald Trump or Brexit. I mean, the problem is that we are in a very new political dynamic when populism, patriotism or nationalism and protectionism is rising. What I hope is that Europe doesn't just muddle through, but actually is forced to make a clear-cut statement of its vision and to bring the economics and the politics closer into alignment so you really can build a continent that is vibrant and functioning. The other thing is that I used to work in Brussels, and I can tell you the bureaucracy in Brussels makes Washington look positively rational half the time.
Wow. That is a statement for the ages right there.
Well, maybe they're both pretty low bars. But, you know, this gigantic bureaucratic machine is just hideous. And that's exactly why the Brexit vote happened. It's why many European citizens feel so out of touch. So then urgently needs to be a way to inject much more genuine democratic accountability and transparency into the process to make it survive in the future.
Mark, what do you see?
Well, I think there's a kind of glasses half full, glasses half empty problem here. So if you look at opinion polls, despite all it's been through, the euro is still popular. In pretty much all countries, a majority of people, in some cases a large majority, think the euro is a good thing and they're quite happy with it. And even though there's a rise of populist sentiment right across the continent, it's mainly the centre-left parties which have been collapsing, and they've been in trouble for a long time, way before populism and before this stuff, even the financial crisis. So there's a way in which there's a surge of nationalism, but there's also a surge to a certain point. You know, they're not taking 50% of the vote. They're not changing everything. So, again, glasses half full, glasses half empty. For many Europeans, the euro works. For many Europeans, the Europe that has been built is still a positive and attractive vision, particularly in comparison to a nationalist alternative, particularly if the United States is seen as the other that this is reflected against. So it's not all doom and gloom by any means. I mean, it's definitely the system has taken a good beating over the past 10 years. And exactly what Gillian says, there needs to be some real recalibration of effective voicing democracy for European peoples. And they really need to do things about the scandal of European mass unemployment amongst young people, particularly in southern Europe. But these are tractable problems. These can be addressed. And if they are, Europe will still be here.
Mark Blythe is professor of international economics at Brown University, and Gillian Tett is the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times. Thanks so much to both of you. This was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I hope we're not too gloomy.
Website, we've got a fascinating article from Politico, which has a different take on Europe's lack of military spending. It's something that President Trump mentions a lot and that Mark Blythe referred to. But this article argues Europe being dependent on the American military, that's not a bug in the system. It is the system that America helped design. We've got the piece for you at our website, innovationhub.org.